ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, Sinead Mangan back with you for Australia-wide in 2026. On the show today, communities in regional Victoria begin to assess the damage done by the fierce fires burning across the state.
Some people have got no houses to go home to. I was helping a guy sawing up a tree off the road and I stopped to give him a hand to just move the branches and his chainsaw went blunted. He said, "Oh, I'll just go back and sharpen the saw." And then he turns to me and he goes, "I've got no shed, I've got no chainsaw, shut up, I'm not going to go back to anything." Oh, that's devastational when you've got nothing to go back to other than a house. And some people haven't even got that.
And we head to the southwest of Western Australia, where packed beaches prompt locals to call for a cap on visitors during peak tourism season.
How many sheep can you put in a paddock before you ruin the paddock? It's about working out what the real carrying capacity of the area is and then finding ways to manage and restrict the numbers that come here.
I'm Sinead Mangan and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk Country, Perth.
We received the devastating news of a loss of life. Our thoughts go to the family, the friends and the community who are impacted by this. And our thoughts are also with all those who are still doing it incredibly tough. Those people who've lost their homes, 47 in Harcourt alone. These are communities that are under real pressure. In addition to that, in far north Queensland, of course, we see the impact of the floods. This is a really tough time across Australia with different impacts of these extreme weather events.
The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, speaking from Canberra about the floods and fires affecting large parts of regional Australia. Firefighters in Victoria are continuing to battle uncontrolled blazes across the state. The Longwood fires in the north of the state has taken the life of cattle farmer Max Hobson. And there's been huge losses to property and livestock in the fire's path, with estimations of the loss of more than 350 homes and structures, and they are still counting. The latest livestock losses sit at 15,500 head of sheep and cattle, but that number too is also expected to rise. The small town of Natimook in the western part of the state was smashed by fire on Friday, and our reporter Angus Farley recently spoke to farmer Michael Schutholz about the grass fire that devastated his property there.
We got the fire warning and basically 10 minutes later it was at our place and we were fighting the front of it and it just swirled around and took our house out and kept going. So it was just over that quick.
Yeah, so just no time at all to do anything?
No, just react. We just were out hitting the fire at the front of our house on a lentil stubble and there's probably 4 foot flames in the side and 6 foot flames out the front and we thought we were getting on it, but the cloud mass above us in the front there, it was carrying the embers. It just was ahead of us, and it was through the property before we knew it.
And Michael, you believe that the house was actually on fire before the front got there?
Yeah, so I was just talking to a friend that was helping us out during the fire, and we were discussing it, and we've worked out the roof had to be on fire before the front got to the house, because when we saw it, it was well alight. So the embers had to have got in the house before we realised. And the house was gone within 10 minutes. The house was destroyed.
Nothing to be done to save it.
No, my wife was in the house and, she was very lucky to get out. The ceiling was dripping, plastic on fire on the carpet. And another minute in the house and, she might not have been with us.
How is your wife? Because that must have been just terrifying.
Oh, she's, sort of had nightmares about it and she's very shaken up about it. So, it's very traumatic for her. She lost 4 cats in the fire and, she's blaming herself for not getting them out, but there was just no time to do anything.
Your whole family was there throughout this, Michael, doing what you could to fight it.
Yes. My son and myself and a good friend all had a fire units each and, we thought we were pretty well prepared. But, after the fire passed, you realise how inadequate we were, really. It was a horrific fire, and I've been to Grampian fires and Harrow fires, and I've seen firestorms, but for something that was out in the open, and it was burning across the lentil stubbles, doing 80 Ks. I've never seen anything like it.
And on that point, we're not talking really about a bushfire. This is a grass fire. Did you ever believe that a grass fire could behave like that?
No. I had all the confidence that we could have, you know, held it up on the lentil stubble in front of our house if it came that way. And I never dreamt, you know, I've been involved with the CFA in past years and helped, you know, do fire breaks around Nanaimo and that, and I would never believe that we would have lost Nanaimo like we have. It's just something I never would have dreamt of, to come through the town and you actually get, you know, buildings and houses in the main street.
And a long road back for you, yeah, your neighbours, and the whole Nanaimo community.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Look, you know, they're reporting 30 homes lost, and that's going to gutter Nanaimo. And, you know, with all the other troubles that we've had in town, it's not what we needed. So, yes, it's going to be a battle, but it's a very strong community, and, yeah, I believe in it, and I'm sure it'll get back on its feet.
What support do you need from the government?
Yeah, something to, you know, boost businesses back up and make it easier for people to get back in and, you know, not have to, you know, we got phone calls about support, but then they want emails and all this information, and you try and explain to them that you've got nothing, everything went up in the house, like I don't even have a wallet on me, every bit of paperwork's gone. It takes a bit to explain it to them, so it just makes the process pretty frustrating. They really need to look at the big picture and of these communities and do something of substance, not just talk.
Nanaimo farmer Michael Schutholz speaking to reporter Angus Farley.
ABC Australia Wide.
Volunteers are definitely the backbone to emergency response in Australia, with bands of people whipping into action to help out during times of cyclone, fire and flood. The New South Wales State Emergency Service now has plans to harness this people power as a way of boosting its response to the growing number of natural disasters. Reporter Claire Simmons describes how the SES is harnessing the people power of so-called mud armies.
Down a little further, keep going.
Metre and a half.
That's the sound of new volunteers being trained at SES Foster Pacific Palms on the New South Wales mid-north coast. Since major flooding devastated the region last May, a surge of volunteers, many from community-led clean-up mud armies, have joined local SES units like that in Foster. The May 2025 floods marked the first time mud army recruits became SES volunteers for the day, as SES manager Andrew McCulloch explains.
We've seen these types of spontaneous mobilisation of community before during major disasters. What separated this event was that it was so different because we had that level of interaction between government, the SES, and the community. There was that partnership working together.
The SES gave Mud Army recruits a safety briefing, protective clothing, tools, covered them with insurance, and sent them out with trained leaders into the field.
Make sure you have food and water, okay?
And SES Commissioner Mike Wassing says this approach has made a big difference.
We do normally see a bit of a spike in interest in terms of new members coming to the organisation post the disaster, which is tremendous. But in this case, what we saw was an extraordinary number. We had nearly 500 expressions of interest and applications, which is extraordinary, and in a very short period of time.
Andrew McCulloch says the idea came from a Churchill Fellowship World Tour of Disaster Zones.
So the Turkish earthquake in 2023, the Japan earthquake in 2011, and the 9/11 terrorist attacks, where the community saw a need, where the government couldn't provide that level of assistance, and the community stepped up to help in these major disasters. We've learned a lot from those disasters to help inform our approach in New South Wales SES.
For future disasters, the agency plans to partner again with community groups like the Mid-Coast Community Flood Response, which mobilise those mud armies to help clean up. One of the group's leaders, Sophie Curtis, coordinated jobs and workers during the flood emergency.
You could tell that's what the community want to do. Like, they're putting their hand up and they want to know what they can do and they want to help and they need someone to direct them, and sometimes having that community organisation in between really helps mobilise an incredible resource, humans, into a really tactical and operational response.
And now she is herself one of the new SES volunteers.
Maybe we'll be up on the roof again in the harness.
Blythe McLennan is the manager of the Australian Institute for Disaster Resilience. She and other disaster researchers have been calling for agencies to harness these mud armies.
What I love about the example in Taree is how it's brought together the strengths of the SES and the community mobilisation to create a more effective response for communities. It's a surge capability for the SES, so what the SES was able to achieve is greater.
Dr. McLennan says the Taree experience matches research which shows volunteering rates are not declining.
We have a shift away from longer term volunteering to more episodic, time limited volunteering. A lot more volunteering that's happening in association with the workplace, so corporate and work sponsored volunteering. Have digital volunteering or use of digital tools.
For Sophie Curtis, joining her local SES unit has been fulfilling.
We've done an incredible amount of training since we started. There was actually quite a bunch of us started right after the floods, and we're just really excited and eager to be trained and upskilled just like everyone else so we can get out there and respond. There's pretty much not a week that goes by without our unit responding to calls for help in the community, so we love it.
That's new SES volunteer Sophie Curtis, ending that story from Claire Simmons. A new health report has revealed a stark divide between the well-being of regional and city-based West Australians. While metro areas sit closer to the state average for many health measures, many regional West Australians rate their health as fair or poor. Rachel Jackson reports from Broome.
From smoking in the Kimberley to higher obesity rates in the Goldfields, the new WA Health Survey has identified shortfalls in well-being across the state. In the south, levels of anxiety and suicidal thoughts scored the highest compared to other regions. This came as no surprise to those working on the front line of the issue. CEO of Azeka Health, Crystal Lorench, says the southwest provider experiences a high rate of referrals throughout the year.
Our team have probably seen this for a very long time. We've been providing these services into the southwest for most of our 30 years of operation. It certainly is quite difficult for staff members to see this day in, day out. Certainly, though, it is really important to us to make sure the services keep coming through. We are very happy about the additional investment that's come through as far as telehealth services in this current budget, and there are new services also coming to the southwest area in the space of suicide. So if somebody has had a suicidal crisis, there will be more services coming in 2026 to support those people.
In the state's far north, the 2024 WA Health Report found almost 1 in 4 people smoke regularly. That's more than double the national average. Health coach Lucinda Usher, who works for Quit Smoking Support Service Better Health Company, says access to help can be challenging outside metropolitan areas. She says telehealth and phone-based support could help bridge that gap.
It's been really helpful. I would say most of my Western Australian participants as well are regional, like not in Perth as well. So it's definitely broadened that reach, and I think been able to help participants discover as well what other services are available in their area, but also, as we said, like the telehealth or like the over the phone as well. And I think a lot of people benefit from that, like non-judgmental, you know, it's a phone call. We're building that trust as, you know, health professional and client.
When it comes to healthy eating, the number of people struggling to put food on the table in WA is growing. More than 8% of Western Australians who took part in the survey said there was a time in the past year that they had run out of food and could not afford to buy more. In 2020, the number recorded from the same report was just under 3%. Professor of Public Health Christina Pollard at Curtin University said the growing levels of food insecurity is a key concern.
So the most alarming things for me, particularly for our regional and remote areas, is the increase in the proportion of people who are experiencing food insecurity. Food insecurity is regular access to safe and nutritious food. And when people can't afford to buy nutritious food to feed their family, then, you know, it's not something that they can control. So that's when we really need to get government in. A surveillance system works when it highlights a jump, and we've seen that recently in the area of food and food security in Western Australia.
In a statement provided to the ABC, a spokesperson for the state government said it was committed to boosting West Australians' health. The spokesperson said the government will continue to work with stakeholders and experts to explore ways to enhance well-being.
Thanks to Rachel Jackson for that report from Broome in Western Australia. In summer, WA tourist towns like Dunsborough, Margaret River and Yallingup experience an influx of summer visitors, and this season is no different, with some tourism operators seeing a 60% rise in visitors. But some locals are worried their hometowns could become too crowded unless visitor numbers are controlled at attractions and beaches. In Dunsborough, there are concerns the town is reaching its tourism limit, and some even say visitor numbers should be capped. As Jackie Lynch reports, it's a divisive idea.
It's a pretty busy day down at Dunsborough's Mealup Beach, about 250 kilometres south of Perth. Cabanas are up, kids are playing, and many people are swimming in the beautiful blue water. In the car park, cars are circling, while others have chosen to park on the side of the road instead. Jeff Forrest has lived in Dunsborough for almost 40 years and has seen local beaches get busier and busier.
Each year we see something crazy. There's been times where on the coast you can't get a car park at all, not even along the side of the road. The locals are learning to try and avoid those peak periods.
Jeff Forrest is also chair of the Dunsborough Reference Group. He wants the town's visitor numbers capped by limiting accommodation spots, saying the extra people and cars are damaging the environment people come here to enjoy.
How many sheep can you put in a paddock before you ruin the paddock? It's about working out what the real carrying capacity of the area is and then finding ways to manage and restrict the numbers that come here. We welcome tourists, but if we're not careful, over-tourism will actually destroy the character, the amenity, the natural environment, the beauty of the area that we've got to sell.
Down on the beach, the idea is not so popular.
I really don't see the point. I think it's better to cater for them. I think you've got to expect the tourists. It's a paradise, really.
The beach is for everyone, regardless of how busy or not busy it is. So I think to put a cap has just been a little bit selfish and greedy of people who live here. And in comparison to Sydney, this feels like, you know, at like 5 or 10% capacity.
We feel like for a really busy time of year, it's been quite a nice beach to come and enjoy this afternoon. Tourism boosts the economy here so much, and we want to respect locals as much as possible. We see people out swimming and enjoying their time, but I think if you put a cap, you could hinder other organisations in that.
The city of Busselton has already cracked down on short-stay accommodation like Airbnb and people who own them. But Mayor Phil Cronin says council is unlikely to intervene further. He thinks the issue will fix itself before numbers grow to levels seen in some parts of Europe and the eastern states.
So if we get to a point of saturation, then this won't be such an attractive place to be. We're juggling balls to make sure that we offer the best facilities to our community, but also we have to understand that tourism brings in $1 billion a year just to this area. So we have to embrace tourism.
At one of the region's biggest attractions, the Busselton Jetty, staff are also thinking about over-tourism.
A very warm welcome to the iconic Busselton Jetty.
As many as 10,000 people went to the iconic 1.8-kilometre jetty in the week after Boxing Day, and CEO Lisa Shreve is conscious there could come a time when too many people want to visit.
Over the last 10 years I've been here, numbers have gone up about 66%, so we need to make sure that we keep the place special. I suppose it just comes down to you won't be able to move. I mean, there are days like jetty swim days where you technically can't move within the space that you're in, and we don't want that to look like that all year round. I've been lucky enough to travel, and when you go places around the world like the Trevi Fountain and you see 10,000 people standing there, it really impacts your experience if you have to be so congested, you don't get the best experience.
Busselton Jetty staff are looking at ways to spread out visitation over the day and may eventually cap the number of people it takes on tours.
I don't think that we would cap walk tickets at this stage, but we definitely have to cap underwater observatory and train tickets, but we might work out a way to sell the tours and do them differently.
And it's not just towns around the southwest heaving with visitors this summer. Parks and Wildlife officers recently warned of chock-a-block car parks at beaches around Denmark on WA's south coast. The advice from rangers, if your favourite spot is busy, stay away and come back another day.
Bunbury reporter Jackie Lynch with that story. Environmentalists are excited for the freshwater white-throated snapping turtle after counting a record number of clutches this season. They've been relocating eggs into predator-proof cages on the banks of the Burnett River in southeast Queensland to give the next generation of the critically endangered turtle a better chance of survival, as Grace Whiteside discovered.
We're out on the Burnett today, one of our historical nesting banks, the first bank that we ever come to when we started 9 years ago, actually. Pretty special spot. We've got our cage set up. Yeah, so this is what we call an historical nesting bank for our critically endangered white-throated snapping turtles, where we relocate all of our eggs back into this cage to protect them from predators, our native predators and introduced predators.
Brad Crosby is the general manager of Wild Projects, a not-for-profit group that works with young people to help protect the environment and develop their connection with country. The group has found 187 clutches this season.
It's been an amazing year. We've never had this amount of clutches before in the last 9 years. So this year has been an extraordinary year for us.
Can you pinpoint a reason as to why there's been more clutches this year?
No, look, we always work backwards in conservation. We observe things and then we look at our observations and try and put it together. But if I had to go back to 2024, we had an explosion of dragonflies. We were out on the river and there was just thousands of dragonflies. And then not long after that, there was an explosion of cicadas. And then followed by that was statewide flooding. And this year in 2025, we witnessed the same thing with our dragonflies. They were indicators for us that it was going to be a similar season. And so we've only worked this the last couple of years that they were just indicators of big rain. And as you've seen across our state, we've had big rains again.
Out of the clutches Wild found, 93 had already been destroyed by predators, but the other 94 were relocated to the cages.
Sometimes you can just push on the ground a little bit just to see how close they are away from emerging, and like you've just seen, that ground just collapsed and now we're just looking at a critically endangered hatchling that's been underground for 6 months. Like, it's super cool.
Oh my God!
That little fella.
The white-throated snapping turtles are known for their unique bum-breathing trait, as the freshwater creatures can extract oxygen from the water through a gill-like structure in its cloaca. The critically endangered creatures are believed to live only in the Burnett, Mary and Fitzroy catchments in Queensland.
So we have to get up really early in the mornings before the predators. We know where some of the traditional nesting banks are.
Marilyn Connell has been involved in conservation work for freshwater turtles in the Mary River, south of the Burnett River, for 25 years. She's project manager with Tyro Landcare.
We go and look for tracks, look for nesting sites, and then protect the clutches, with mesh, etc., to protect them from any native or feral animals.
It's a humbling experience, actually, just to witness the laying and the hatching of these white-throated snapping turtles.
Bruce Wire is an Indigenous project officer with Wild Projects, which stands for Where Youth Live Dreams.
It's a reflection time too, because we're seeing new life and birth of a species that's going to, like, most likely disappear if we don't do the work we do.
For Mr. Wire, sharing the experience with young people is especially powerful, because he sees similarities between them and the hatchling's journey.
It gets emotional because I get to be that one to hold the space so that the youth can see that their struggles are quite real, and they're looking at these babies coming out of the ground and going to the water and seeing straight away they're in survival mode, and like, without us, they probably wouldn't even made it to the water with certain processes that we put in place, just to give them that fighting chance. And the same thing goes with our youth.
Pretty amazing.
They're quick.
Oh, they're proper quick.
Back on the banks of the Burnett River, Brad Crosby sits and stares out at the water after releasing a hatchling.
You know, if we talk about people, we've got a love language. We've got a love language, and that's why we're doing this for this turtle. Like, we care for it, and that's why we do what we do.
Brad Crosby, General Manager of Wild Projects, ending that story from Grace Whiteside, and they were chatting there on the Burnett River. And that's Australia Wide with me, Sinead Mangan. It's great to be back with you.
ABC Listen.